This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
This week, a strange sound. Well, dealing with wildlife, it's never predictable, and I've got a big, huge, furry microphone that looks like a cat.
Well, so if you stand back.
She might not be that keen, but no. Yeah, you go for it.
She's actually just had a bath.
She's just had a bath.
She likes to have a bath every day when she comes back.
She's lovely.
She'll come down in a minute if we stand back.
We'll give her some time,
yeah. I'm sure she'll come back.
Yes, Ewan will be meeting that poor lady's granny shortly.
Yeah, if you've got any ideas on that one, stay with us. We're keen to hear your stories. And you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. That's another strange noise up there, is that a...
Yeah, no, just right up there.
Jackdaw?
Crow? No, there was a crow right up there.
Yeah.
Give a little Aldi.
See him, yeah.
We actually heard a lot of bird song this week, or bird cries, because we were right down in Carlaverock into Freesin Galloway.
Yeah, right down the southwest tip of Scotland, and an amazing sunrise. It's for a programme we're going to be bringing you next week as part of the podcast, but basically looking at winter, and we had just so many birds to listen to.
Yeah, it was fantastic. But first, making a successful business out of being a tenant farmer is never easy. It's actually extremely difficult. Even if you've been doing it for years, with potentially generations of farming experience going before you.
So if you're not from a farming background, why would you want to take on what is effectively, it's not a job, it's more a way of life? Well, earlier this week I met somebody who's done exactly that.
I'm Andrew Marchant, this is Clonhee Farm, sitting in Pen Punt, which is Thornhill in Dumfriesshire.
And if folk don't know this part of the world, it is beautiful, rolling countryside, fields everywhere. This is sheep country, this is cattle country, and in front of me I can see deer country as well.
Yeah, this is a diversification we introduced about 18 months ago, Ewan. So we were predominantly beef and sheep. Being new entrants to agriculture, it's quite a common theme that you tend to start out with sheep. It sort of requires a bit less capital and you can sort of get your money turned over a wee bit quicker.
Well, let me take you back to the start, because you look every inch a farmer, but you weren't originally.
No, so neither Aileen nor I came from a family farm, but I had a sort of brought up in a rural area and got the bug from a young age and decided I wanted to farm. So I got a degree in agriculture, worked from there up into a farm manager's job, but the goal was always really to farm in our own right.
This is a lovely farm. This is a big farm, 750 acres.
Yeah, there or thereabouts. So, we were pretty lucky. The end of 2011, Buccleuch Estates here, they sort of wound up a bit of in-hand farming on this estate, and they had quite a bit of land to let out, and this farm was sort of outlying and was identified as one that would be suitable maybe for a new entrant.
So how does that work? Is that word of mouth, or do you see it in the paper and say all of that?
Yeah, no, it was advertised in the papers, and I mean, I'd been every Friday morning I'd be buying the farming papers first thing in the morning. The first thing I'd do would go to the back and see if there's any farms for rent. And this had been on for quite a while. And eventually Clonhee was advertised and it just ticked all the boxes for us.
What's that like? You're sitting there at the dining room table and there it is, the advert, the farm you want. Perhaps you're going to get it. You don't know at that point.
Yeah, it was it was exciting, but you know, we'd been to view quite a few farms across the south of Scotland, and when we drove up the road into Clonhea, it was the first time I really had that gut feeling this was the one that was best suited for us, and so we threw everything at the tender to try and get the farm, and unfortunately we got the tenancy, so we're very lucky.
Do you have to have an interview for that as well?
Yeah, so we were shortlisted and then interviewed from there, and I think we were the type of people they were looking for. We were young and ambitious, but we were also quite well qualified, and because I'd managed a reasonable sized farm business, I was sort of reasonably well qualified to start my own business, hopefully.
You touched on it earlier on. There you are, you've got 750 acres and no livestock. How did you go about that?
It's a daunting task, and that's the age-old problem with starting a farming business. There's so much capital required to get going before you'd always see any cash coming back in. So, yeah, we had 12 ewes when we came. We had a wee sort of hobby flock of ewes that we brought them with us, and then we just set about building the sheep numbers as quick as we could. But really, the way we did it was my wife's a teacher. She kept her teaching job, and I went out and worked full time on other farms for the first 3 or 4 years, and then we just farmed at nights and weekends, and that allowed us to reinvest everything in the farm and build up numbers as quick as we could.
So, how long was it before you turned in a profit? Were you still waiting?
No, it was quite important for us to make a profit as quick as we could. So sort of by the second and third year, we were making a profit, and you know, that was because there's a lot of people who put a lot of faith in us. You know, our landlord, the Duke of Buccleuch, but also the bank that financed us and got us going. You know, these people have put a lot of faith in us. So I felt a lot of expectation, and I felt I had to be turning a profit and make my business commercially viable as soon as possible. Also, knew that I wanted to grow the business, so to do that, I would have to borrow more money, and I needed to build a track record and build a bit of trust. And
so you got some money coming in from the sheep. You move into cattle then?
Yeah, I mean, after a few years, we decided we would start a small suckler herd. Beef production's pretty difficult to make a profit at in Scotland, but we've got a bit of hill that we can outwinter some cows, so we've got some ling cows, which are, you know, real hardy native Scottish cattle, and we outwinter them, and it works quite nicely for us. But after that, we decided we needed to diversify into something else, and this is when the deer plan came into action.
Why deer?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had an interest in deer. My father was involved with deer farming as I was growing up, so I'd had an interest in them for a long time. The venison market's good. It's a growing market. You know, venison's a really healthy, lean meat, so I could see some real potential in that market, which to me, if we're going to produce anything, we need to see that there's a market there and there's a bit of potential. It's quite important. Also, I love the animals. You know, you can see them pottering around in front of us here. They're just beautiful animals to have on the place as
but
well.
A big investment in terms of fencing. You know, it's not like a sheep fence that's 3 feet high. This has got to be 6 feet high.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason there's not deer farmers all over Scotland, because you know, you can't buy two or three and try them. You've got 100% commit. You've got to put the fences up. You know, build a handling system. You've got to be set up for it. So, but we did the numbers, and we spent a lot of time in researching, and we decided we had a real good business case, and the bank was willing to go with us. And our deer business, we've done a bit of collaboration, and we've went into it as a joint venture with our landlord. So it's something a wee bit different, and something we're really pleased with so far.
It's all looking good at the moment. Was it challenging on the way?
Yeah.
You must have been sitting there. What the heck have we done?
Oh, we still get nights like that now. Still get sleepless nights. But there's been a lot of challenges. But anything that's, you know, if it was easy, we'd all be doing it. I'm quite a positive person. I managed to keep upbeat, and I do quite a lot of figures. I annoy the hell out of Aileen by sitting doing back of the fag packet figures all at nights and stuff like that. So as long as I've got it in my head that where we're going in the right direction, and I know we can manage it, then I'm okay. But I know it's tough, but you know, if anything's worth doing, it's always going to be tough, and it's worth taking a challenge, and I was keen to have a crack, so I don't regret it at all.
Andrew Margent there, along with his wife Aileen, won the New Entrants Against All Odds Award at the recent British Farming Awards.
Beautiful farm, right up on the hill, looking down the Nith Valley, lovely rolling hills. I mean, if you cast your mind back to All Creatures Great and Small, the series about the vet in the north of England, that lovely countryside, dry stained dikes everywhere, beautiful part of the world. It's just a lovely farm.
Although, don't you think that having an award called New Entrance Against All Odds is an indication, or an acceptance of just how difficult it is?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be seriously dedicated. It's not something you'd take on by chance, but yeah, no, they're making a good job of it, a good business plan. Mm-hmm. And of course, put your wife out to work as a teacher. It's always a help. I think the plan is that once they're up and running and turning in a profit, then she'll probably give up the job.
Yeah. Andrew spoke there about his Ling cattle up on the hill. Now, obviously, they're not there for ornamentation. They're basically beef cattle. You've got to do something with it eventually. Butchery is a skilled profession. It's got many opportunities, both at home and abroad, but it seems to be a career path that an awful lot of folk just aren't keen on at all. It's strange.
Yeah, well, one of the arguments might be that it's not the best paid in the world, although we were looking at some statistics suggesting that Glasgow pays about 30% more than the rest of Britain, but it's still not... You couldn't compete with an electrician, say.
Interesting. Well, I spoke to a lady called Louise Forsyth from family-run Butchers Forsyth of Peebles, and she told me how this skill shortage, and it is a real skill shortage, actually affects their business.
The butchery starts with us. We buy our cattle live at the market, and then they come back to the shop in, you know, full sides of beef. So we need the skills in our business that the guys can work from a full carcass down, get the bones out, and do the whole butchery job, and also manufacturing in our business. So we've got, you know, really core skills that are important to a business like ours. We have to have those skills. And they're really, they are, it's, you know, people think butchery is just hacking away at something. It's not. It's a really skilled, yes, skilled job to do.
There's an awful lot of young people nowadays, never mind the idea of cutting up an animal, they just don't like the idea of meat.
Well, for me, you know, I eat meat, I choose to eat meat. I don't have a problem with people that don't choose to eat meat. I choose to know where my meat comes from, know how it's got on my plate, to be familiar with the process and to be happy with that process. In Scotland and in the UK, I think we have the highest standards going. And I buy my cattle live. I'm happy for them to come into the shop. Our guys butcher them. And I do go to schools as well and try and get this message over. In fact, I'm off to Hoyk on Friday to try and get kids to, you know, they get a bit of meat off a supermarket shelf wrapped in cling film. And it's to understand and appreciate and actually value the amount of work that's gone on from the farmer, right, you know, the hauliers, the livestock marts, the guys in the abattoirs. It's all a very skilled job. And if that job's not done skillfully, it's a wasted product.
Yeah.
And just to get people to look at that bit of meat and just value it for what it is.
Getting people into the business of butchery is problematic. Is that a new phenomenon?
No, we were aware of this at least 20, 30 years ago. We were aware that when you advertised for butchers, you were not getting skilled butchers coming through looking for work. And we're very lucky. We live in a beautiful place like Peebles. It's a really nice place to live, nice schools to send your kids to. And yet you really struggle to attract people into the workforce. And that has carried on. And you know, we filled the gap at that time with a lot of Polish workers coming through, and we had a guy, very good, 7 years, learnt a lot with us as well, worked really well, and then of course he's gone back home now, and we are not getting those people coming through looking for work the way we were. Mm. We advertised for a skilled butcher recently. We didn't get anybody. We had two or three people came looking to learn the trade right enough, and we've actually just taken on a girl, and it's great. It's a girl, Ava, and she's doing really well, but the challenge will be keeping her.
I was about to ask, I mean, skilling these people is one thing, retaining them is another.
It's very difficult retaining them, and in the last two, for example, our last two apprentices we had one chap, he'd worked with us before he left school, came in, did his apprenticeship, great guy, worked really well, qualified, and then he decided he didn't want to work weekends on a Saturday, and his lifestyle meant he made another choice with a job career. And that's frustrating because you've put a lot of work into someone young, mm-hmm, they're coming really well, and then that's happening, you know, they decide to leave and move on to something else. Another apprentice, he's just qualified and he's decided to go traveling next year, so we'll be losing him too. So it's, you put the work in, you get these people, they learn the skills, but it's keeping them in the industry.
So what's the solution?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. As an employer, we're very flexible. You know, we do. We try to be as flexible as we can be with work hours, adapting to people's needs. You know, if they've got childcare needs, these sort of things, we do try and adapt to that and be quite a flexible employer.
But that's got a cost.
It has,
you know,
a cost.
Being flexible and being adaptable is all very well and good, and it's desirable, and it's actually, and a lot of times, written into law. But it's expensive.
It's expensive, and especially to small businesses like us. But we have to go with it. And I think the other thing, unfortunately, and talking to other people in the industry, is they're looking at more mechanisation, which is tragic because you're going to lose the skills. You know, the guys that work in our manufacturing, one of them has worked. Eric's worked with us for nearly 40 years. And to get somebody like that again, you know, you will not replace Eric. He's just the mainstay of our manufacturing and has been an amazingly loyal employee for all those years. And everything in our manufacturing is, you know, as done by hand as possible. So our sausages are hand-linked. But if you can't get people into manufacturing, you'll have to invest in a you know, a mechanised linking machine, which a lot of people are having to go down. And I know, talking to some of the people in the big processing aspect, they're looking at going a lot more mechanised as well.
So it's not just a case of, you know, you have to be able to cut up meat. You are making your own sausages, your own black puddings, white puddings, everything else.
Everything. Customer service, you know, that is all connected to a small traditional family butchers. Although we employ up, you know, roughly about 38 people between the bakers and the butchers.
So what's changed? What's changed in such a way that you can't get somebody to come in, skill up and actually work in the same job for 40 years?
I really don't know. I don't think we sell ourselves very well. And I think, you know, I've been saying it for a long time. We had seemed to have this ethos that you had to go to university. Hmm. Everyone was to have a university degree. It was not, you weren't worth anything if you didn't have a university degree. It didn't matter what it was. And I was, you know, years ago, I was saying, you know, for goodness sake, these skills that we have are valid. I would much rather have people coming out of school and going into a skilled labour force and learning a skill. And I'll tell you something else. If you train as a butcher now and learn really good knife skills, you'll get a job anywhere. And these are skills
anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. And these are skills that are very transferable onto other types of work, you know, chefing and these types of things. So, you know, I just don't think they've been given enough value and enough respect.
Louise Forsyth there, of Forsyths of Peebles.
I don't think it's probably brought to the attention of people when they're leaving school as an option.
Yeah.
Certainly it's not one I can, this is a long time ago. Remember the careers officer at that time saying, you know, this is an option.
And when you handed back your slate.
Well, I actually had a slate when I was in primary 7.
You never did.
I absolutely did. A slate with a wooden frame around the edge and chalk. But we did have jotters as well. Uh-huh. Those lovely, the real nostalgia now. Those blue jotters with the tables at the back.
Yes.
How many furlongs are in a chain and how many chains are in a cable.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Tremendously useful when you went into the Royal Navy, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, an online description describes a small holding as, and I'm quoting here, a residential site with more land than a garden but less than a farm, which is not hugely useful. But there's actually more to being a smallholder than the size of your plot of land, as Laura Guthrie found out when she went to meet Rosemary Champion.
This is Dalmore. It's a 12-acre smallholding on the outskirts of Carnoustie. We now have been here for 10 years. We breed Shetland cattle, Ryland sheep, we fatten pigs, laying hens, orchard, and various diversification activities that we're working on.
Okie doke, what's all going on? We're having a wee wander around.
Don't look to your left, because that's the bit we haven't got to yet. So coming around here, you can see the sheep. That's our Ryland sheep there. We have coloured Ryland ewes in here. We've got three Shetlands. That's Kit, Bambi and Scoot. And we've got three black blue-faced Leicesters called Roo, Alice and Skippy. And then there's the Rylands. The top is in there. Uh-huh. He's in there for flirting purposes until the 1st of November, when he'll be allowed to join his girls. So we've kept Ryland since 2007. We keep them for meat and for the fleece. We have the fleeces spun into knitting yarn, which we sell under the Dalmore Croft brand, and we sell lamb and mutton when we have it.
They're quite an interesting looking sheep. They've got a lovely woolly face.
Yes, you'll see they have wool from the tip of their nose to the just above their feet. And they are great smallholder sheep because they're not very big. They're really docile.
They're very docile. They're right up. I mean, I know that you're...
This is Neve.
She's
Neve's very old. She's 9. So the Shetland cows you'll see over in the field there. Mm-hmm. 3 cows, bull, 3 calves this year. And we milk them for the house. And we sell prime beef. We've just had our beef day, where the steers came back and butchered packets, and we made them up into beef boxes, and our customers came and picked them up. So we've been involved with the Rare Breed Survival Trust for a long time, and we wanted to support British rare breeds. We particularly wanted to support Scottish rare breeds. So when it came to choosing a breed of cattle, the Shetland was the one to go for. And we've not for one moment have we ever regretted it. They are terrific cattle to keep. They're hardy, they're cheap to run, they're docile. The beef is absolutely second to none.
So you said you've been here for 10 years. Yeah. Was that you starting out in small holding then, or what was your background?
No, I mean, I'm not from a farming family. I did a degree in agriculture back in the early 80s. Then went off and did other things. Life changed and you know, I went into local government. And when Dan and I met and married, we decided we wanted to grow some of our own food. So we dug up the front lawn of our house and planted vegetables. And then we bought two semi-derelict farm cottages with a paddock. So there we got our first hens, we got our first pigs that we fattened for the freezer, and we got our first three coloured Ryland sheep, who were called Juno, Jura and Jinx. We don't have them anymore, but we do have daughters and granddaughters from them. So that was 2000, we started our first small holding, and then in 2009 we wanted something a bit more land. I wanted cattle, and then we moved up here, and I got my first two cows off Shetland in October of 2010.
So when you started, you're saying small holding, but I mean, it's a huge undertaking. You still were working full-time, both of you?
Yeah, we were both working full-time to start with, and then Dan went to work for himself, and then I left local government in 2009. So I'm effectively full-time here.
If you were to define being a small holder or having a small holding, how would you define that?
Well, that's one of the problems with small holding, is that there is no definition. Crofting has a nice, neat definition, and everybody knows what a croft is and what a crofter is. We smallholders don't have that luxury. The good life is a blessing and a curse for smallholding.
I wasn't going to bring it up. But you have.
Well, I have. And it is, because it can range from back garden farming to 50, 100 acres. There is no definition, and that makes it very difficult. If you put 100 smallholders by their own definition in a room and ask them to define what they do, they would struggle to do it, and everyone would be different.
Do you think it's more of a mindset, a mentality? Is that a bit of a, you know, a fluffy thing to say? But in terms of being a smallholder, is it about the kind of goals or how, you know, how you want to achieve things?
Yes, I think so. I think people who are farming on a small scale are very often, and you know, I don't want to tar everybody with the same brush, but they're very often first generation farmers. Very often they don't come from farming families, so they're feeling their way for the first time into a land-based business, and very often they're coming from a background of wanting to do things in an ecologically sound way. Not saying everybody's like that, but in my experience, a lot of smallholders have the environment very much at the forefront of their mind. And for a lot of us, fortunately, we have other income streams that make us in a position where we're not having to try and farm hugely intensively. And we often do come from non-farming backgrounds, so access to education, training, information is always interesting, because everybody has an opinion and everybody's an expert, and sometimes sorting out the wheat from the chaff can be challenging.
But also in a way possibly quite nice and refreshing to not be bogged down with maybe generations of this is how we've done it and this is how it will be done, and you know, you don't have that.
Absolutely. And in fact, our vet likes working with smallholders because we tend to do what we're told. We ask for advice and then we do it, because we don't have granddad maybe offering advice in the background. So we're maybe open to new techniques because we don't have any old techniques to build on. One thing I really hate is a sort of them and us, that there's farmers and smallholders and that somehow farmers are bad and smallholders are good, or the other way around. We have far more in common than divides us.
Smallholder Rosemary Champion, then we'll hear more from her later on in the podcast.
Great, though. I've always fancied it as a way of life, but I imagine it's pretty hard.
I would have thought it was really difficult. I mean, we've got a small holding. It's about just slightly less than 9 acres. But we just keep the horses on it and we take haylage off it, but that's it. You know, it's not as if we've got chickens and pigs and ducks and geese and sheep and everything else.
Fancy the polytunnels and just no attention.
See, I think I would quite fancy it, but whether I'd actually stick at it, that's the key point.
I'm sure you'd put in a good afternoon.
Oh, as long as that.
And then move on
to something much more interesting. There is a reason that, you know, the vehicles that we drive about nowadays have their power translated into horsepower, because for a long, long time that is basically what drove certainly farming and an awful lot of transportation. It was literal horses. However, the skills behind that kind of work, you know, being able to take a horse into a field, do something useful, are slightly dying out.
Yeah, they are dying out, which is a bit of a shame. But I went along to speak to the world champion horse ploughman to find out a bit more.
Walk on, Tom, Pat, get up, go on. Go on, away you go. Go on. Come on, Tom, get up, go on. I'm Jim Elliott, and I'm a handyman at Hadda House and National Trust Properties.
And Scottish champion, British champion, world champion at horse ploughing.
Yeah, that's right.
And here we are at Pitmedden with an absolutely manky field. It is boggy.
Yeah, there's been a lot of rain this last two or three nights and it has made it really wet on the top.
So who are the horses we've got here?
Tom's on the right, he's a Shire Cross, and Pat's on the left, he's an Irish Cob.
And they're one size different from the other, is that a problem?
Not really. It's nicer if they're the same size, but at least they're the same colour.
So why did you want to get involved in using a horse to plough?
Well, I always had a pony when I was young. From about 4 or 5 year old, I had a Shetland pony. And then we went to a ploughing competition in Lancashire in 1971, I think. And I saw a chap, Bob Hull, they called him. He was ploughing with horses. It was their 50th anniversary and they'd brought horses back for that year. My father used to plough with the tractor and I just sort of forsake him and went off with Bob. And I was with him all day and, as they say afterwards, I eat half his sandwiches and whatever. And the rest's history. I just said on the way home that I wanted to plough with horses, and Dad said we had a horse plough lying behind a hedge somewhere and we pulled it out and cleaned it up and we borrowed a pair of horses for the first couple of years and then gradually bought them and started from there.
OK, let's go. It's seriously boggy. You've got one in the wet furrow and one in the dry.
Yeah, OK.
What happens?
Right, we'll just let it in at the end here and keep the wheel up against the edge, and that keeps your width and the wheels keep the depth. You just have to steer it. Walk on, Tom, Pat. Get up, go on. Go on, away you go. Go on. Come on, Tom. Get up, go on.
This is quite an incline you're going up.
Yeah, it is a bit of a hill, but we have ploughed worse, but it's easier when it's on the flat. Go on. Walk on.
So you've got a combination of whistles and voice commands?
It is. It's mostly voice commands. There's not a lot with the reins. You need the reins to stop them if you don't stop with the command. Come on, here, walk on. Go on, walk on, Tom, step in.
So what are the commands?
Walk on to set them off. G back to the right. Come here to the left. Whoa, to stop.
G bank.
G back to the right, yeah. Come on, walk on.
So is that the same whatever you go?
No. Scotland, they usually shout hey in Wish. And the RY is down in Yorkshire. There's all different commands for different parts of the country.
That must make it difficult, because presumably ploughmen used to go to different parts of the country during the season.
Yeah, just getting the horses used to it. It wouldn't take long.
Yeah, but you've competed in Denmark.
Yeah.
Do you have to learn Danish?
No, it would have been handy. They didn't work well, to be quite honest, because, you know, they didn't understand me. And fair enough. When you shout, whoa, here, it's brr over there. So it... And you always, when you catch the stone or you wanted to stop, you thought, oh yeah, you shouted woo and they didn't stop. And then you had to go brr, but then you'd gone 2 yards past where you wanted to stop. So it wasn't a lot of help, but we still managed to win it.
Is it a dying art?
Yes, I think so, unfortunately. I wouldn't like to admit it, but we've got to be truthful, and I think it is because there isn't the youngsters coming on now, unfortunately. And it's an expensive hobby to get into, and there's no prize money or very little prize money, so you have to be fairly well off to be able to keep horses.
But there is work, though, isn't there?
Yeah, there is work for them, and a lot maybe more in the forestry industry than there is maybe on agriculture, but who knows, if petrol and diesel runs out, might have to go back to them yet.
OK, what happens now? We're at the end of the drill.
Yeah, we'll just go out lane and turn right. Come on. Come on, walk on. Get up. Go on, lads. Get on. Tom. Good boy. Slowly. That's the lad. Slowly. Go on, get up. Whoa. Come on.
OK, we're going to give it a wee go. Is there anything I need to know?
No, just keep the wheel up against the edge and keep it straight.
It's a heavy thing, isn't it?
Come on, step in.
OK, so...
What's step in. That's it. Go on, Tom. Where you go. That's it. Just lift it up and it'll go in. Go on, yeah. Where you go.
So you just keep that wheel up against
the
edge?
Yeah, yeah. Come on, Pat. Come on, Pat.
Oh!
Come here, that's it. Go on.
Feel a bit of power in there.
I know. Go on, Pat. Go on, get up. Get on.
So do they think they enjoy this?
I think so. I don't think you'd be able to catch them in the morning if they didn't. But, no, I think they do enjoy it, really. Go on, get up.
Do you enjoy it?
I do, yes. If it's good conditions and a good day, there's nothing better.
This is getting quite stony. Is that a serious problem?
Yeah, it hasn't been ploughed for a while, but yeah, we will have to pick some of the stones. But they're not really big, they're just sort of rumbling stones, and there's a drain being put in here, there.
Oops.
So it's a rattle up, but go on. It's only for a yard. Go on, away you go.
How do you get that bit back in? Just
just push over and it'll come in. Go on, Pat! Pat! Get up. That's it, she's away. Steady.
This is quite satisfying.
Yeah, I like to see the furrows turning. And we're looking at it from a different angle to the tractor. You're always looking back on the tractor. At least we're looking forward.
So would a tractor have been able to plough this? Because this is really boggy.
Well, the modern tractors, four-wheel drives, would, yes. But a Fergie or an old Fordson, no, I don't think so. Whoa. Whoa.
Whoa. Okay, let's have a wee look. That's not bad.
It's good. That would have won a match at many places.
Without a doubt. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Jim Elliott, champion horse ploughman. I have to say, it sounded like they were actually ploughing bog.
It was absolutely bog. The minute, I can't remember which horse it was, put its foot in the furrow and it was just
squelch.
A big, huge splash. It was one of those fields that was almost impossible to walk in. It was kind of... But the point he was making, a Fordson tractor or a wee grey Fergie wouldn't be able to do it. Whereas these guys just ploughed on right through it. And if you go on our Facebook page, you'll see Jim in action. And if you go onto the BBC iPlayer, you can see me having a wee go on Landward. And yeah, it's very satisfying, but hard work.
I remember going, you know, we've got horses, but I remember going down a track somewhere in the central belt, and there was somebody in front of me leading a Clydesdale. Now, even for a Clydesdale, this Clydesdale had big feet, you know, and you could just, you know, it was half light. You could see these feet coming up, and they were enormous, about the size of dustbin lids. So that kind of thing, I mean, that they're designed to cover a lot of ground so they can go into boggy ground, and they were deliberately bred that way. And those feathers at the back of their legs, the hairy bits, that's to cast the rain off it so the heels don't get all cracked. They thought of everything.
It's almost, I was watching, it's almost like somebody having a paddle with a canoe.
Yeah,
they're paddling through the water, whereas these Clydesdale were just pulling their way through the mud.
Yeah.
But beautiful, beautiful animals. Great.
We spent, as I was saying earlier, the early part of this week into Freesing Galloway and the Borders. Now, down in that area, possibly because of the proximity to England, just across the other side of the Solway and on the other side of the Tweed, you see things that you don't see in other parts of Scotland. For example, the habit of hedge laying. Graham Walker is a commercial hedge layer, and I met up with him on Bow Hill Estate near Selkirk.
What I'm doing here with traditional hedge laying, Mark, is we're taking this 14-year-old hedge, this one is. It's a maiden hedge. It's never been laid before. And the technical process of hedge laying is to, as you can see here, is put an acute cut into the stem and split it down to the point where you can form a hinge and then bend it over. So that hinge comprises basically the bark, the cambium and a bit of sapwood, and that allows the transport system up and down the plant to remain functional. The bark protects the outside and the sapwood gives a bit of support. And that's sufficient for that stem that's been laid. We now call that a pleacher. It's the pleaching is the process of cutting it through, and then it becomes a pleacher when it's laid. So what will now happen is that from that stool at the bottom of the plant here is the cambium, and the sapwood here will callus over, it will heal.
Okay, the cambium's effectively sort of the inner skin of the bark.
Yeah, it's several cell layers that actually allow transport of nutrients throughout the plant. So below that, it will start to form buds all the way around here, and that stool will send out five or six new shoots, and they will grow vertically up through these pleachers, which have been laid at an angle of about 35 degrees, and the new shoots will come up through those, and it will knit together into an impenetrable barrier, which becomes a living fence.
You've got the living stuff at the bottom, but you've also got these. These look like hazel wands to me or something of the kind.
A mixture of hazel and birch.
Okay.
And these are binders. So when we've laid over the pleachers, I then drive stakes down through the laid hedge, approximately 18 inches. It's a man's arm, roughly. And then across the top of that, I take these hazel and birch binders and I weave in a binding, then drive the stakes in hard, and the whole thing becomes solid and strong.
Can you show me how you actually bend over those pleachers? What do you use to actually make that cut?
Okay, so there's a little plant here. We can do this one. This is quite easy. So obviously, I've got a variety of tools here. I've got principally a chainsaw, hand bill hook, and this is a Norfolk pattern bill hook. They're all kind of regional in style, as you also have regional styles of hedge. So with this little one, can I just
swap places? No problem.
Just clear this away. So just clear away this excess stuff here with the hand
hook. Cutting off the side branches.
That's it. So it'll actually lay into place properly because there's too much brash in there. So with this little thin stem, which is about an inch long, I'm going to put a blow just about here, fairly subtle blow. Now I'm holding the top of it because that gives me some pressure on the plant and a sensitivity when I hit it. I can feel when that cut runs. So if you just watch it now, it should just go in one cut.
Okay.
And there it is.
Right.
And that's all that's required for a little thin one like that. And I'll just lay straight down into the hedge like that, with a bit of manipulation.
What does this do for wildlife?
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. So if you look at most of the hedges you see around here in the borders in the Scottish lowlands, I mean, they were all planted as living fences, but post-war, with mechanisation coming in, lots of labour on the land, a lot of the traditional practices, which were done in southern Scotland. All these hedges around here would have been laid up until the 50s at the latest. They all become, if you look at them now, you'll see they're all quite stout stems at the bottom. There's no growth in the bottom. And because of contemporary flailing, like you can see the line in this hedge here.
Well, basically, they just put a tractor along with a flail and it just chops it to pieces.
It chops the top up and you can see it becomes a knitted mass at the top. And in the bottom, there is no actual hedge cover. So for wildlife value, this doesn't have much value as it is just now, nor do the relict hedges that you see around about. You get the odd bird, you know, there's a few goldfinch nests along here, not very much else. But there's no cover in the bottom for the small mammals or amphibians or reptiles. So when you lay this over, that then thickens up the whole hedge, and this becomes a fantastic thick corridor for wildlife to transit, and it takes...
It's like a tunnel, basically.
It's a covered tunnel that gives all the little animals security, and it allows them to travel from habitat to habitat. So it becomes a wildlife corridor. And that's even more important in areas like where I am down in the Merse in Roxburghshire, where you've got almost universal arable farming, and there's nothing in the fields, there's nothing for wildlife. So very much all you've got is the margins, and specifically the hedges. So by doing this, you increase its ecological value manyfold.
I mean, I can see that this is quite a skilled job, an extremely skilled job, as a matter of fact. How many hedge layers are there in Scotland? Any idea?
There's very few. There are people who you will see around cutting hedges, but I'm unaware of anyone who's doing it on the commercial scale I do it. For instance, I'm completely booked out this season, which runs from 1st of September to 31st of March next year. If you go...
Why then? Why those dates?
Essentially, what you want is a dormant hedge with no wildlife in it. So the birds have stopped nesting, they've gone. You want, ideally, the leaf off the tree because there's a huge amount of weight in that leaf cover. And also you can see more clearly what you're doing when the leaf cover's off. And traditionally as well, this was the off-season in farming. So you would do your hedging, you do your diking, you do your ditching, all those tasks that had to wait through the until the end of the year.
How did you get into it?
I mean, I can't imagine you rocking up to some guidance teacher 30, 40 years ago and saying, what I really want to do is...
Well, I'm an archaeologist by profession, and
it's an obvious leap.
It's an obvious leap. So I first saw it. I moved down south, 40 years ago, and I first saw it in Gloucestershire and Oxfordshire when I was working professionally in the field. Didn't know anything about it coming from Scotland because you don't see it at all. But luckily, I worked with a chap who did know, and he introduced me to the craft. And then I did a little course with BTCV, as it was back then.
British Trust for Conservation Volunteers.
That's the one. And it pretty much lay dormant with me until I moved back up to Scotland in 2003 and discovered that we hold the Scottish National Championships actually here in the Borders at Ancrum. So I got involved in that just as a novice, cutting a hedge once a year, because I have another profession as an artist blacksmith. So, I didn't really have time for hedge laying. So it's only really in the last, say, 10 years that I've given more attention to as an important aspect of bringing value to the countryside. And actually, I've now diversified my business. I kind of split it between the blacksmithing through the summer and this through the winter.
I have to say, I'm lost in admiration for this. It just makes a very pleasing shape to the eye. How much of this can you actually do in a day? Because it must be quite time-consuming.
This style's quite time-consuming. This is what we call the standard hedge or the Midland hedge. And it's a very strong hedge because it's got to resist bullocks in the grazing side over there. So that's why it is heavily built. That's why there are so many stakes in it, and that's why it's got this very heavy binder on here. So to lay a hedge like this, you could, a skilled man doing well can do a chain a day, which is about 22 yards. So that's cut, laid, staked and bound.
Yeah, a chain.
A chain. It's a great thing about hedge laying is it works on it, those old human measurements. So I mentioned before, so the distance between your stakes is a man's arm.
From elbow to fist.
To fist, yeah. And the height above the binder is a fist.
Yeah. 4.5 inches roughly.
Yeah, it works on that sort of principle.
Yeah. It must be really satisfying to do.
It is. Once you've seen this, I mean, I've got about a quarter of a kilometre to do both sides of the road here. So once you've seen this whole thing laid from what it is now, it is very aesthetically pleasing and very satisfying. And you're doing a great thing. It's the best thing you can do for a living hedge.
Hedge layer Graham Walker there.
Yep, and they're springing up all over the country. It's great.
Yeah. Interesting career progression, though. Yeah. Started off as an archaeologist, then became an artist blacksmith, and is now a hedge layer. Actually, he's an artist blacksmith and a hedge layer because he does the artist blacksmithing during the summer. When you think about it, you're in the forge when it's actually fine weather, and in the winter time, he does the hedge laying. He has to do it then because the birds aren't nesting.
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
It's all wrong.
You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Tell us where you listen. You know, share your thoughts. Tell us what you're doing, no matter where you are in the world.
Indeed. Let's go back to the outskirts of Carnoustie now. While Rosemary Champion's home might be described as a small holding, the ambition behind it is huge.
So more hens in amongst the lovely orchard.
Yeah, we planted 50 apple trees 7 years ago and 50 apple trees 5 years ago. We've lost a few over the intervening period. We've got 80 left. So they're now starting to come into full production. And we mainly make apple juice to sell, pasteurised apple juice. And we just sell that locally. So in here we've got, these are this year's hatch. That's their cockerel, he's called Rocky. He's very small, but he thinks he's very big. I can't remember what he is, a Pekin Bantam.
So people will have gathered, you've obviously got sheep, you've got cattle, we're in amongst the hens now, there's apples. You have an awful lot going on here.
We do, and I guess we're not untypical of most smallholders. Many of them are doing lots of things on a small scale. It's probably what farming was like 100 years ago. Our main driver has been to produce food for ourselves. That's where we started from, and that still underpins what we do. I mean, we eat the apples, we drink the apple juice, you know, we eat the eggs and the beef and the lamb. But we also want to be producing food for local people. If folk can buy stuff locally, they can support local businesses, it counts in food yards rather than food miles. And that's important to us, and it's obviously important to our customers. And we're by no means alone. If people want local food, look to your local smallholding community. And local smallholders, I hope, will rise to the challenge and produce food to sell. One of the reasons that myself and some other people were involved in starting Smallholding Scotland was to give smallholders a voice. Smallholding is the kind of Cinderella sector of farming. We're not well recognised by government. We don't get much support. If we could get organised to get a bit more support, not just financial support, but that's important, but access to information, to appropriate training for people who are farming on a small scale, who don't have access to big machinery and don't want access to big machinery, then we could transform the smallholding sector in Scotland to be an absolute powerhouse of food production. I mean, I think there is a lot of interest in local. We're not organic here. We're not registered organic. I would argue that we farm on broadly organic principles. It doesn't seem to be an issue for our customers. What our customers are interested in is being able to see the hens, to be able to bring their grandchildren down to see the hens and the pigs when they're here. We keep three pigs every year, three weaners. We keep one for ourselves, we keep one for a friend, and we have a community pig, which is shared by about six couples in Carnoustie. And we love that. We don't do it for profit. We do it because it helps people get in touch with where their food comes from. And I think a lot of smallholders can and do the same sort of thing. One of the things I think we're not terribly good at in smallholding is growing fruit and veg for sale. And I think that's a big opportunity. Scottish Crofting Federation, Scottish Agricultural Colleges are running a lot of courses just now on polytunnels and horticulture in the Crofting counties. I would like to see that replicated down here because there's a market for that, for fresh fruit and vegetables grown locally. And if we could get some cooperation going, then smallholders could be starting to feed a lot more into the local food system than maybe we currently are.
There's a lot of discussion at the moment about mental health in farming and, you know, people that live quite solitary lives and things. And it's tough. I mean, we're here today. It's a reasonably nice day. And yeah, this looks great. I'd love to be here. But in a couple of weeks' time, when it's dark, when you get up, dark, when you're doing your work, it is difficult.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, mental health is an issue in all aspects of life. I think maybe smallholders are cushioned from it in comparison to farmers, because very often we do have other income streams. We may have other work areas that take us off the smallholding for part of the time. You know, very often farmers are 24/7 on their farms, on their own, with severe financial problems, and that must really grind you down. But on the other hand, in smallholding, you're out there, you're working the land, very often with hand tools, you're hands-on with your livestock, you know them. And, I mean, there are proven health benefits of getting your hands dirty and you know, spending time with animals. It's a healthy way of living, of being in contact with, well, nature, I suppose.
And if you don't mind me asking, when you are unable any longer to physically cope with, you know, all the demands here, what will happen to your smallholding?
Well, that's a difficult one. We have nobody in the family who's interested in taking it on. However, what we do want to do is to look at some options where it continues as a smallholding. It would be nice to be able to protect this so that people will continue to have access to local food from this land, and it will not just be houses. You know, I would be gutted if there was houses where my cows are now.
Smallholder Rosemary Champion. And if you want to find out more about Smallholding Scotland, there is a link to their website from ours, which is Out of Doors.
Interesting concept, the idea of a community pig where you all get together, because you know, it's a bit challenging looking after pigs, but if you've got somebody that knows what they're doing and you can have a part of that and a sense of ownership, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it used to be the case many, many years ago. You know, that folk would sort of, you know, like half shares in a pig.
Yeah.
Anyway. We said earlier, we like hearing where you listen. But Martin Finnan got in contact saying, I'm from Glasgow, currently living in Abu Dhabi with my husband, where we both work at the moment. I wanted to write to say thanks so much for the informative, inspiring, often funny, sometimes thought-provoking, but all-round wonderful podcasts.
I wonder what she's listening to.
That beats me, I have no idea.
It goes on to say, I usually listen while out on the water in the early mornings on a stand-up paddleboard, and it's so good for the soul to be transported back home to the outdoors I love. You cover such varied topics that I never know what's coming up next, neither do we, but I'm never disappointed.
She goes on, I'm always telling people about the show and the things I've learned from listening. When we move home, we're looking forward to catch up on checking out all these places you talk about. Martine, well, thank you very much for
that. Here we are, plus 1 degree,
yeah,
asleep in the snow, and you're out there in the sunshine on a paddleboard in the early morning.
Yeah.
You want to rush home?
Let me think about that for a while. Last week, you might remember, we put a call out for Jill, the owner of Jacko the Jackdaw, to get in touch, as we were keen to meet Jacko, who Jill said had rescued from a certain death, was how she put it.
Well, yeah, she got in touch with us here at the BBC and said that she'd rescued Jacko and that Jacko can talk. Well, we were intrigued, to say the least. Now, whether Jacko can talk or not, I shall leave it up to you. And I met up with Jill on her farm near Carlops to hear the story of Jacko. And happily, we did manage to find her.
I was in the cattle shed one day and this Jackdaw nest fell off the rafters right in front of us. Two young in it, one of them was dead and the other one was scrabbling about and the cat was scrabbling about as well. So as you do, you pick it up and brought it up and put it in a box.
And then
the gape is looking at you, this big red mouth. Of course, it just gobbled everything I gave it in the box and just grew. The only downside is that with the fall, we reckon it's a she must have tweaked her beak. I unbelievably took her to the vets at the bush and we think she maybe fractured her bottom jaw when she fell, but it wasn't very apparent at the beginning, it wasn't apparent at all. But as she's grown, she's got this slightly twisted beak, which doesn't affect anything except that possibly that's why she comes back and has her supplementary food from me, I don't know.
So what stage is she at now?
She'll be, what, 5 months or something, 4 months? June, once she could fly, I let her out and I actually took her on holiday. I went up north and there was nobody to feed her every few hours, so she had to come too. And she actually learnt to fly on this Scottish island where I was staying.
Did you not think you're going to lose her at that point? You know, you open the doors and bye-bye.
Yeah, she couldn't really fly when we were there, but she was taking her first steps. Anyway, we came back and I let her out and she just flies around the farm, basically. And if she sees me, she comes flying down onto my shoulder. If she's flying with her pals, I can shout. She comes veering out the sky and does a loop-the-loop and lands on my head or wherever.
And you were talking to her?
I talked to her, yeah, but she talks to me. I mean, I talk to everything, but she talks to me.
Now we're going to get over and listen to the recording in a wee while because you've actually got her locked up at the moment.
I took the liberty of... I don't like closing her in at all because she's free. She comes back when she wants. She goes away when she wants. She mostly comes back at night, the afternoons, and goes into the aviary where I reared her. And she roosts there. But sometimes she stays out all night and the next night. And in September, she disappeared for about 3 weeks and I thought she was gone, she was dead. So that was that. Anyway, after 3 weeks, she appeared back even fatter than she was when she left, which proves she can feed herself, and all her new feathers, adult feathers, were grown in. But she had a sneeze, a bad sneeze, you know, a virus or whatever. So I did take her to the bush again, and they actually jagged her with antibiotics, but we think it was a virus, and it took about 3 weeks to go. So I shut her in for about a week at that point, after which time she was hopping to get out. So she's been free ever since.
Well, tell me about the talking. When did that come about?
I don't know, really. I think possibly when they're maturing, I think. Or maybe it's the squint beak, I don't know. But she certainly talks. She's even got my parrots. I've got African grey parrots. They actually imitate her now, which is really quite funny. So I've got it outside and I've got it inside as well.
So where is she at the moment?
So she's in an aviary in here.
Okay.
So and I can guarantee when I open it,
she'll fly out. But
she'll fly
that's
out.
That's okay. She's a wild bird.
She's a wild bird. If I call her, she comes down. She usually comes around the garden with me in the morning on my shoulder. And then I drive down to the yard to feed cattle and things. And she hops about the rooftops and flies down and flies back up and chats to everyone from the roof.
Well, dealing with wildlife, it's never predictable. And I've got a big, huge, furry microphone that looks like a cat.
Well, so you stand back.
She might not be that keen, but yeah, you go for it.
Okay, I'll just see what happens. Hook-a-doo.
Quite exciting. Just opening the door.
Jackal, you can come out now.
Going to the Avery, I'm staying back.
She's actually just had a bath.
She's just had a bath.
She likes to have a bath every day when she comes back. She doesn't like the Come on, Jackal.
Where? Oh, yeah.
Come on.
She's lovely.
She'll come down in a minute if we stand back.
Give her some time,
I'm quite sure she'll come back. Yeah, she seems to come in and have a bath, have some more food, and then flies off again. It's a great life. She can live wild or come and help herself.
She's got a real sense of satisfaction.
Yes. I mean, I would never keep a bird like that in a cage. And you just see how wild birds are when I see her flying around, because she doesn't come near me when somebody's here, like you.
That's me.
I have land at the other side of the main road, the other side of Carlops, and sometimes when I'm going around the cattle there, she comes flying out of the sky and lands on my shoulder, so she's obviously flying quite a distance.
Well, I'll maybe get out of her line of sight and see if that that helps her. There she's arrived, and on your shoulder.
Scared of you?
She's giving me a funny look.
Yeah. She's all wet.
She's looking a bit drooked. You can see a slight bend on the beak.
Yeah, it's just a wee bend. It doesn't seem to do any harm, really.
It's giving us a right old eyeing.
She will take off in a minute, and she goes right up in the air and then does these incredible drops to earth, where I think, well, that's it, she's going to break her neck.
She goes, she goes.
Yeah, she's waving for her friends now.
What a lovely story.
Jill Noble and Jacko the Jackdaw there.
That's right, Jacko. Kind of hard to disagree with that.
Yep, too straight. I think you probably need a degree of imagination to make Jack aware of that. But
yeah, but it's
great that it'll come to her.
It'd be good to have a pet jackdaw. I mean, obviously you can't take jackdaws from the wild in Scotland, but if it was going to die anyway, I think it's just a great story. And it'd be just lovely. Be out in the field and then suddenly the jackdaw comes down.
Yes.
Perches on your shoulder.
Well, not terribly far away from here lives Esther Wolfson, who wrote a really good book called Corvus. She's became an expert on corvids, members of the crow family. But she lives in a really nice house. I mean, I don't know if the thing's still alive, but she had a pet rook that she rescued when it was quite young called Chicken, Mrs. Chicken Boomskaya. And it would just hop about the kitchen. Yep. And, you know, and it's tame as get out. Interesting.
Clever birds.
Yep. Now, it's funny how things can be in your doorstep and you can miss them completely if you're not careful. Nearly happened to me last week when I discovered Alton's Bees, which is just a few miles away from where I live. Now, the lady behind Alton's Bees, Angelica Edmund, as you will hear, is a bit on the passionate side about bees.
Yep. Here I keep my five hives. Honeybees do not hibernate, so they are active all year round, all winter.
I've never seen hives like these before. Ordinarily, the hives I've seen have been either hard plastic or wood. This looks like foam.
No, let me tell you something. They're classic hives, but they got bee jackets.
Bee jackets. Okay.
Well, imagine the delivery driver guy when he came and says, bee jackets? I said, yes, but it's for the hive. Yeah. Ah, all right. So.
Lots of little jackets for bees. Get the wings out through the armholes.
You are so confused. Bee jackets. So this helps bees not to use so much energy and food during the winter.
Okay.
To keep 30 degrees into the hive.
Okay, wow.
So the hive is very warm. And this first year when I blocked the entries only to two holes side, basically because of the wasp attacks. Yes, this year wasps killed four of my young colonies. It's never been such a bad beekeeping year. And I never seen so many wasps attacking my hives.
How did you get into beekeeping in the first place? Have you always done it?
No, it's just I always loved bees and pollinators and bumblebees, and I thought it would be nice if I keep my own and start it as a hobby, turn it into a small business, but it will always stay as a hobby.
And how did you learn to keep bees? Because it's not straightforward, it's not easy.
No, it's not. Thanks to my beekeeping family, which they taught me all about it. And then you do the hard work by, and you learn by yourself. Mm-hmm. So I did have some tough experience, and I learned as you can do mistakes without realizing, but following my instinct always helped. So I have a very good instinct about them. And now I'll tell you honestly, just if I put my nose into the hive, I know if my queen is fertile or no, just Seriously? From the smell. Yeah, I can smell the pheromones. And the way you listen to a phone call, that's how if I hear the buzzing, I know what's going on into the hive. So each colony individual is different, and I can understand each hive just from smell it and hearing.
When you got the, you know, your first couple of hives, and they are delivered to you presumably with bees in and things, was there honey in them too? Did you?
No. When I bought the hives, my teacher said, you'll bring it and we'll help you extract the honey. And I said, well, I'm not really a beekeeper and I didn't work for the honey, so I don't think I deserve it. So I said, please bring the hives in August after you extract all the honey, leave plenty for the bees, and teach me how to look after all winter, and then I'll be happy to get my own honey in the summer. So I did. It's been a really hard work all winter, and the preparations, and during summer work and looking after them. So imagine the reward of having my first honey and pure, raw, cold extract honey. I mean,
you don't eat it at all to extract it. It's just gravity takes it out, essentially.
Yes. So from the frame goes straight into the jar without being altered in any way. So every jar of my honey is full of life, full of enzymes.
Full of pollen too, I don't know.
Full of pollen, rich pollen. I use just the basic filter.
Can I try it? You've got a jar of it there.
Yeah,
just
I got the jar for you.
Oh, that looks fabulous. You know, it's the colour of winter sunlight. That is lovely. That is really nice. It's almost like a sort of an aftertaste. It's like honey with something on top of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very rich in flavour.
Yeah.
And this year has been a bad year for them, so they had more clover forage than anything else. So clover honey is supposed to be the best in the world, the most healthy one. So this is what I have in the jar. That's why it's so golden shiny.
Yeah.
This is why I call them happy bees. They're the most spoiled bees in the world. I left in August the hives full of honey. I mean, I could hardly move the frames. And so they have plenty of food. And then I top up with cakes I call during the winter just to make sure they stay strong and healthy till summer.
I know you pursue something called ethical beekeeping. You know, what's the sort of keynote? What makes ethical beekeeping different from any other kind of beekeeping?
I call it cruelty-free beekeeping. Mm-hmm. So basically, bees first. And honey, if it's anything left for me, that's the second. Okay. As I said, it's just a hobby. I love bees and I love good honey, but really good honey. This is the reason I started doing beekeeping, because I couldn't find the honey I like it. So the taste of my honey reflects the good of the bees. And I'll tell you a story. In my first year of beekeeping, I had 13 swarms coming to my two hives.
13?
That's not possible, and that's not normal. And my teachers were shocked. I mean, we were collecting a swarm, and then I see a big cloud of bees on top of my head coming again, and I said, wow, another one, and we were all sweaty and finished.
Just explain the significance of that, because beekeepers love swarms, because eventually what...
bees.
Yeah, well, free bees, essentially. I mean, essentially, a community of bees gets too big, it kind of splits off. Part of them head off into the wide blue yonder, and if you're lucky as a beekeeper, you can catch it. But to have 13 swarms heading in your direction is just extraordinary.
I'll tell you why. Bees follows bees. So once they've seen my bees happy and strong and healthy, they said they have a good spot. So they will follow up and they'll chase to make a nest right here.
Aside from the obvious thing, getting honey, you also produce these wax wraps. So we'll come back into your house. What do you actually do, though? How are they made?
We need to go 100 years back in time, when our grannies used to use beeswax fabrics to wrap everything around. That was before plastic came up. So basically I melt the beeswax from my hives and I wax pure cotton fabric into it, and using it, wrapping all the vegetables in fruits or bread or pastries, they last, I think, 5 times longer than normal. So that helps preserve food naturally, because beeswax has antibacterial properties.
You've got the stuff here and it's flexible. Can you clean that?
You just wash it with warm water and soapy water. I'm going on the principle, which everybody will understand. Just try and get one drop of beeswax from your shirt.
Yes.
Okay? I'm telling you, you will never be able to do that. So you can't take the beeswax out of my fabric either.
So by using one of these sheets, essentially, you don't have to use cling film. You
That's
don't have
right.
to use tinfoil, anything like that.
That's right. All the chemicals are out. So basically, using the beeswax wraps, you cut off all the chemicals from cling film. You no longer need to use any paper. Keep one with you in your rucksack, in your backpack. And anytime you can't finish your sandwich, just wrap it in it. Anytime your child eats just half a muffin, you know, wrap it in it. So you cut off a lot of packaging.
Angelica, do I look like the kind of person that can't finish a sandwich?
No, not really. Sorry about that.
See, I liked her up to that stage. Well, right off her off.
Yeah, hard to disagree with her.
Straight talking Angelica Edmund there, and the most spoilt bees in the country.
A lovely honey as well.
It was beautiful honey.
Yeah.
Beautiful honey.
Great.
But she also gave us some of those wraps, which I've forgotten to bring in, but I will bring them in. There's wraps for everybody.
It was interesting, because you brought some honey back, and I was making some beer from scratch, from the hops and the whole shooting match. And it says, you know, I've got another week to go. When you bottle it, rather than putting sugar in the bottles, put a wee drop of honey in it to get the secondary fermentation. I thought, ooh, I've got high-quality honey to put in my homemade beer.
Excellent. Oh, well, I shall look forward to a bottle of that.
A whole day's work for 5 bottles of beer. Ridiculous.
Indeed. Anyway, this just last week, we were down in the freezing Galloway at Carlaverock on the Merse there, and we got there about 6:30 in the morning, and we're walking down this track, and you've got high hedges either side, pitch dark, just a suggestion of light on the horizon, but a lot of light in the sky coming from a nearly full moon.
Yeah, well, it was a full moon that night. It was just perfect. Mm-hmm. And as you say, it was gorgeous, because we got all these geese and the swans, and we'll bring you that next week, and trust me, it's a real sound experience. You will love it. But it had a wee look about the significance of the moon in November, and it's really important for wildlife in Scotland. I'm looking up at one of the great sights at this time of year, a full moon against a crystal clear autumn sky. The hard frost has chased most of the remaining leaves from the beech trees, and the massive buttery disk in the sky is shining brightly across the fields and the hedges. The stubble beneath my feet is frozen and crisp as Bracken and I take an evening walk. But tonight is special, very special. In many cultures, the winter solstice, this year due on the 22nd of next month, is a time of pagan celebration. But the full moon of November plays an important part, not only in the lives of nomadic tribes, but also for wildlife. For this week's full moon heralds big changes for our wildlife, and could see the return of an old and an ancient name for tonight's event. The full moon is known in Native American folklore as a beaver moon. The animals are preparing for winter, dragging in a supply of twigs and branches to see them through the coming cold season. And sadly for the beaver, it was a sign to those who hunted the animals for the fur to keep out the cold that it was time to trap as many as possible for their pelts. For this moon is also known around the globe as a frost moon. After tonight, the temperatures will plummet, bringing ice and snow to the land. And now, with the successful reintroduction of the beaver to this land, perhaps the full moon will also be named the Beaver Moon. But perhaps not, as the moon I'm looking at tonight already has a Scottish name. This moon is known as a woodcock moon. The woodcock, originally a wader, has adapted to live in clearings and woodland. Nocturnal birds that you're more likely to hear than to see. A warm chestnut bird with short legs and a long bill and an incredibly fast zigzagging flight between the trees and then suddenly dropping into the undergrowth. Tayside, along the Moray Firth, East Lothian and small pockets of Argyll are home to resident populations of these delightful wee birds. But come the full moon of November and the population rockets. From the breeding grounds of Latvia, Finland, Russia, Norway, Sweden, Poland, almost a million woodcock are thought to head to our shores using the light of the full moon to make the long and hazardous journey. To make it even harder, certainly according to folklore, the full moon also coincided with the arrival of thousands of goldcrests, a tiny wren-like bird, the smallest in this country, with a flash of yellow and sometimes known as the king of birds. And they were thought to have hitched a ride on the back of the woodcock as they made their long moonlight flight. Nonsense, of course, but it gave the goldcrest its other name, the woodcock pilot, as it was thought they navigated the way for the larger bird. So, this week's frost moon, a goose moon in some parts of the world, a woodcock moon, and possibly the beaver moon. Take your pick. But tonight all heralds the coming of the winter storms.
Oh, that's good. Let's finish this podcast on a high note, why don't we?
Well, the goldcrest...
I were doomed.
The goldcrest was happy. I mean, it's coming here to escape the ravages of winter.
Yes, a little avian jockey on the back of the woodcock.
It's such a great image.
It's such a daft idea.
Well, it's wonderful. Hats off to the folk of old. I just love that storytelling of, this is what happened. It hitched a ride on the back and it guided it by the moonlight to our shores.
It may not be the case that woodcocks carry goldfinches, but...
they do carry their young. They've been known for under threat. They will pick up the young with their feet and their knees and fly off through the woods in that really distinct ziggy-zagginess. And, yeah, fascinating birds. And as we said, they're... more chance you, quite often you'll see a flirt, just a blur going past you. Say, what was that? And it was probably a woodcock.
The vast majority of my bird watching is like that.
Yeah, what was that?
What was that? I have no idea. Beats me. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. From all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thank you very much for listening. We are going to go out with something of an odd soundscape, though.
Yeah, we've got Jim
Elliott.
Elliott, who's the Scottish.
British and world champion.
Ploughing champion with horses, and he was trying to teach me how to plough using a horse. And I was there, I was in the field watching him, and this is just such a fantastic sound. There's a squelching of the plough going through the muddy clay. There's the bumping of the stones, which is a really interesting bit. You've got to take care of the stones, because it can fly up and break your jaw. And it's just that lovely, very ancient, very traditional sound. And because I close my eyes, thought, this is fantastic. We'll leave you with it.
This is what in northeast parlance we would call gone through the pluter.
Tom, Pat, come on, Tom. Where you go? Hop, come on. on, get up. Go on. Good boy. Come.